You always said if the church would stick to you, you would stick to the church. Now trouble comes, and you are the first to run. Shamed, Joseph returned to Illinois to face prosecution, fearing the worst. I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, he warned those who rowed him back across the river. Joseph and 11 others who were charged with destroying the press surrendered on June 24th. As they traveled the 25 miles from Nauvoo to Carthage, the roads were lined with Illinois militiamen and other Gentiles who heckled the prophet lustily. God damn you, old Joe, we've got you now. Clear the way and let us see old Joe, the prophet of God. He's seen the last of Nauvoo. We'll use him up and kill all the damn Mormons. In Carthage, the streets were jammed with armed, inebriated, poorly disciplined members of numerous local militias, all screaming for the prophet's head. Governor Ford, determined to protect Joseph and give him a fair trial, ordered all the militiamen in town to disband except for a single company of Carthage Greys, who were assigned to guard the jail and safeguard the prisoners. 10 of the Mormons in custody posted bail and were allowed to go free, but Joseph and Hiram, who had been charged with treason in addition to the less serious crimes charged to the other defendants, were incarcerated in the Carthage jail, a two-story structure with yard-thick walls built from red limestone cut from a local quarry. There were just 6 rooms in the entire building, 2 locked cells for holding prisoners, plus 4 rooms, one of which was a cramped attic garret that served as living quarters for the jailer, his wife, and their 7 children. Initially, the prophet and his brother were held in the downstairs debtor's cell, which was well-lit and reasonably comfortable. The jailer, George Stigall, was not Mormon, but he was a decent man, and he worried that this downstairs cell, with its large ground-level windows, might provide insufficient protection from the enraged men outside who wished to harm his prisoners. So the jailer permitted them to bide their time upstairs in his own bedroom, and friendly visitors were given unrestricted access to the Smith brothers. By this means, 2 guns were smuggled into them, a 6-shot pepperbox revolver and a single-shot pistol. Late on the afternoon of June 27th, while Joseph and Hiram were being visited in their quarters by Apostles John Taylor and Willard Richards, approximately 125 militiamen from the virulently anti-Mormon town of Warsaw assembled outside the jail in the damp summer heat. Earlier, in deference to the governor's orders, these Warsaw dragoons had left Carthage, but they hadn't gone far. They disguised themselves by rubbing gunpowder on their faces and, at day's end, came storming back into town. Just 7 members of the Carthage Greys were on guard when the dragoons appeared outside the jail and charged the front entrance. The Greys fired their muskets directly into the mob, but as part of a prearranged plan, the guards had loaded their weapons with blanks, so none of the dragoons were harmed. After discharging their ersatz fusillade, the guards stepped aside, allowing the hate-crazed mob to burst through the front door, firing their guns indiscriminately as they entered. 2 of their balls came within inches of hitting the jailer's wife. The militiamen swarmed upstairs and tried to force their way into the bedroom where the prisoners were quartered. Joseph and Hiram brandished their smuggled weapons while Taylor and Richards each grabbed a walking stick, positioned themselves on either side of the doorway, and began whacking furiously at the mob's muskets as the barrels were poked through the partially open door. 2 bullets ripped through the door panel. The second one smashed into Hiram's neck, severing his spinal cord, and he dropped to the floor dead, where 4 more balls immediately struck his body. Joseph responded by reaching around the door jamb and blindly firing all 6 rounds of his revolver, wounding at least 1 of the Warsaw dragoons. The attackers had succeeded in forcing the door open, however, and a lethal rain of bullets now sprayed into the room. Taylor, in desperation, attempted to jump out of an open window, but was shot first in the left thigh and then in the chest. Although the latter bullet struck a watch in his vest pocket and therefore wasn't lethal, the impact knocked the wind out of him and sent him sprawling onto the floor. Frantically trying to escape the flying bullets, he crawled under a bed where another ball tore into his forearm and yet another hit his pelvis, cutting away a piece of flesh from his left hip as large as a man's hand. Seeing no alternative, Joseph also tried to spring from the window, but as he crouched above the sill in silhouette, 2 shots from inside the room pierced his back, and a 3rd bullet, fired from a musket on the ground outside, exploded into his chest. Uttering a plaintive, "O Lord, my God," he pitched forward out of the window. The prophet dropped 20 feet, slammed into the earth with a dull thud, and lay motionless, twisted on his left side. A second lieutenant in the Carthage Greys who witnessed Joseph's fall reported that as soon as he hit the ground, he was shot several times and a bayonet run through him. After a few moments, another militiaman cautiously approached the body, prodded it, and announced to the crowd that Joe Smith was dead. Willard Richards, meanwhile, emerged tentatively from behind the door, unharmed except for slight wounds where a ball had grazed his throat and earlobe. When the dragoons had initially forced their way into the room, Richards was standing on the hinge side of the doorway, and as the door flew open, he was inadvertently squeezed between it and the wall. He remained there, standing unnoticed behind the door until the shooting stopped. After determining that all the militiamen had departed, he left his hiding place and walked to the window. On the ground below, he saw 100 men near Joseph's body, and more coming round the corner of the jail. Then Richards noticed John Taylor lying on the floor, awash in his own blood, but still breathing. Taylor's watch, struck by the bullet that would otherwise have ended his life, had stopped at 16 minutes and 26 seconds past 5 o'clock on June 27, 1844. Mormons the world over have committed this time and date to memory, marking the death of their great and beloved prophet. Joseph Smith was 38 years old. Defying the odds, Taylor survived the grave injuries he sustained in the Carthage jail and later became the church's third president and prophet, succeeding Brigham Young in 1877. 9 years after that, Taylor would receive a notorious, furiously disputed revelation in which God would affirm to him the righteousness of the principle of plural marriage, a revelation that would ultimately give birth to the modern fundamentalist movement, lead to the settlement of Short Creek, and transform the life of Dan Lafferty. Chapter 13. The Lafferty Boys. It should be obvious to any man who is not one himself that the land is overrun with messiahs. It should be a matter of common observation that this clamor of voices represents the really vigorous wing of American religious life. Here is religion in action, and religion actively in the making. The truth is, of course, that the land is simply teeming with faith. That marked credulity that accompanies periods of great religious awakening and seems to be, with us, a permanent state of mind. By no stretch of the vocabulary could our age be called an age of doubt. It is rather an age of incredible faith. Charles W. Ferguson, The Confusion of Tongues. After Dan Lafferty read The Peacemaker and resolved to start living the principle of plural marriage, he announced to his wife, Matilda, that he intended to wed her oldest daughter, his stepdaughter. At the last minute, however, he abandoned that plan and instead married a Romanian immigrant named Ann Randack, who took care of some of Robert Redford's horses on a ranch up Spanish Fork Canyon, in the mountains east of the Dream Mine. Ann and Dan had met when he'd borrowed a horse from her to ride in a local parade. She wasn't LDS, says Dan, but she was open to new experiences. Becoming my plural wife was her idea. Anne, he adds, was a lovely girl. I called her my gypsy bride. Living according to the strictures laid down in The Peacemaker felt good to Dan. It felt right, as though this really was the way God intended men and women to live. Inspired, Dan sought out other texts about Mormonism as it was practiced in the early years of the church. It didn't take him long to discover that polygamy wasn't the only divine principle the modern LDS church had abandoned in its eagerness to be accepted by American society. Dan learned that in the 19th century, both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young had preached about the righteousness of a sacred doctrine known as blood atonement. Certain grievous acts committed against Mormons, as Brigham explained it, could be rectified only if the sinners have their blood spilt upon the ground. And Dan learned that Joseph had taught that the laws of God take precedence over the laws of men. Legal theory was a subject of particular interest to Dan. His curiosity had first been aroused when he was training to be a chiropractor in California, following a run-in he had with state and county authorities. At the time, he supported his family primarily by running a small sandwich business out of their home. Dan, Matilda, and the oldest kids would get out of bed before dawn every morning in order to make and wrap stacks of all-natural vegetarian sandwiches, which Dan would then sell to other chiropractic students during the lunch hour. It was a very profitable little hustle, Dan says proudly. Or it was, until the Board of Health closed me down for not following regulations. They claimed I needed a license and that I wasn't paying the required taxes. Just before he was put out of business, Matilda had given birth to a baby boy. Money was tight. Losing their main source of income was problematic. It also proved to be a pivotal event in Dan's passage to fundamentalism. After they shut me down, Dan recalls, I didn't know quite what to do. It didn't seem right to me that the government would penalize me just for being ambitious and trying to support my family, that they would actually force me to go on welfare instead of simply letting me run my little business. It seemed so stupid. The worst kind of government intrusion. In the Book of Mormon, Moroni talks about how all of us have an obligation to make sure we have a good and just government. And when I read that, it really got me going. It made me realize that I needed to start getting involved in political issues. And I saw that when it comes right down to it, you can't really separate political issues from religious issues. They're all tied up together. Upon completing his chiropractic training and returning to Utah, Dan went to work as a chiropractor for his father. By then, the Lafferty parents had sold their farm and bought a house in the old part of downtown Provo. Dan's father ran his practice out of a basement office in this home. In 1981, shortly after Dan started working for Watson Sr., the LDS Church sent both of the elder Laffertys abroad on a 2-year mission, at which point Dan and his younger brother Mark, who had graduated the Los Angeles College of Chiropractic 6 months after Dan, agreed to take over the practice in their father's absence. Dan and Mark had always enjoyed each other's company. As children, says Dan, we were inseparable. Every morning and evening of their childhood, they sat together across a milk pail to milk the family cow. They spent their summer vacations practically joined at the hip, playing in the barns, jumping in the hay, throwing the football, playing in our tree hut, he recalls. It's funny to remember how hard it was to stop playing even long enough to get a drink or take a pee. Nothing tasted so good as cold water from the faucet that filled the watering trough, and nothing felt so good as taking a pee when the pressure got so bad we had to stop playing because we couldn't hold it any longer. When their younger brothers, Tim, Watson Jr., and Alan, were old enough, the smaller boys eagerly joined in Dan and Mark's escapades. Then, says Dan, we'd all line up along the fence, oldest to youngest, and have a group pee. The little guys loved to do what Mark and I did, especially lining up to pee on a fence. When Dan and Mark started working together in their father's office, the special closeness they had shared in their youth was rekindled. During breaks between patients, they engaged in heartfelt discussions about everything that was most important to them, and increasingly what seemed most important concerned religious doctrine and its power to remedy the insidious evils inflicted by the government on its citizens. Regarding the timing of these heart-to-heart talks, Dan reports, I began to observe a fascinating phenomenon. Dan and Mark were usually so busy seeing patients that often several days would pass between their religious-political discourses. But on those days when they would unexpectedly have gaps in the schedule in which to talk at length, says Dan, rather mysteriously my younger brothers would show up unannounced, and we would have some very, very valuable time discussing issues. These impromptu get-togethers happened often enough, says Dan, that it seemed like it had to be more than just a coincidence. 5 of the 6 Lafferty brothers, Dan, Mark, Watson, Tim, and Alan, were usually present for these ad hoc conferences. The only brother who failed to attend was Ron, the eldest of the Lafferty offspring, who was 6 years older than Dan and had always acted less like a sibling than a father figure to his brothers. Dan usually led the discussions, which inevitably described how the government had far exceeded its constitutionally mandated reach and was dangerously out of control. Buttressing his arguments by quoting scripture from the Book of Mormon, he patiently explained to his brothers that the government had no right to require American citizens to obtain any kind of license, or pay taxes, or submit to the oppressive burden of a Social Security number. I had come to realize, Dan says, that a license was simply an agreement with the government to let them have control of your life. And I decided I didn't want them to have control of my life. I already had a basic right to enjoy all of the basic activities of a human being without their permission. Although Dan had not yet allied himself with any established fundamentalist church or prophet, His self-directed studies had transformed him into a de facto Mormon fundamentalist, and an exceedingly ardent one. The impetus for most fundamentalist movements, whether Mormon, Catholic, evangelical Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, is a yearning to return to the mythical order and perfection of the original church. Dan Lafferty was moved by this same desire. The more he studied historical Mormon documents, the more certain Dan became that the LDS Church had blundered off course around 1890, when then-president and prophet Wilford Woodruff was coerced into doing away with the doctrine of plural marriage by the godless government in Washington, D.C. The modern LDS Church, Dan had become convinced, was an elaborate fraud. Like fundamentalists in other faiths, he was intent on adhering unfailingly to God's true commandments, as determined by a rigorously literal interpretation of his church's earliest and most sacred texts. And he was no less intent on adhering to the true commandments of his country's earliest and most sacred texts as well. To Dan, such documents as the Book of Mormon, the Peacemaker, the United States Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence are all of a piece. They are holy scriptures that provide a direct link to the Almighty. The authority that flows from their divinely inspired sentences is absolute and immutable, and it is the duty of righteous men and women to conduct their lives according to a stringently literal reading of those sentences. For people like Dan, who view existence through the narrow lens of literalism, the language in certain select documents is assumed to possess extraordinary power. Such language is to be taken assiduously at face value, according to a single incontrovertible interpretation that makes no allowance for nuance, ambiguity, or situational contingencies. As Vincent Crapanzano observes in his book Serving the Word, Dan Lafferty's brand of literalism encourages a closed, usually, though not necessarily, politically conservative view of the world, one with a stop-time notion of history and a we-and-they approach to people, in which we are possessed of truth, virtue, and goodness, and they of falsehood, depravity, and evil. It looks askance at figurative language, which, so long as its symbols and metaphors are vital, can open, promiscuously in the eyes of the strict literalist, the world and its imaginative possibilities. For his part, Dan scoffs at this sort of pointy-headed exegesis. "I was just on a quest," he insists. "A quest to find the truth." After seeking guidance through prayer and receiving confirmation that he was acting in accordance with the Lord's wishes, Dan sent his driver's license back to the state of Utah, revoked his marriage license, and returned his Social Security card. He ignored posted speed limits, which he believed were illegal, and simply drove wisely and carefully instead. And he quit paying taxes of any kind, including the sales tax when he shopped in local stores, which provoked frequent confrontations with cashiers. Energized by the self-evident righteousness of his crusade, in the summer of 1982, Dan declared himself a candidate for sheriff of Utah County and embarked on a lively political campaign, speaking at public forums, writing letters to the Provo newspaper, doing radio interviews, and riding in small-town parades. He promised, if elected, to enforce the laws according to a scrupulously literal interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. As he explained, "My motive in running was to restore the primacy of common law juries and to restore the fundamentals of the Constitution." On October 4, 1982, Dan was driving home after meeting with another candidate for sheriff, the American Fork police chief, with whom Dan had hoped to engage in a public debate, when he was stopped on Interstate 15 by a Utah state trooper for speeding and not having a vehicle inspection sticker. "I had already had some confrontations with the officer who pulled me over," Dan allows. He knew I would be driving home from this debate meeting, and he had set a trap for me. "They wanted to get a felony against me so I couldn't run for office, and they swarmed me on the freeway. I had just published an important article in the paper, a very important article, which had really unnerved a lot of people, about how the powers of government were being improperly used through improper warrants of arrest, how it was unconstitutional to stop a person on the freeway and arrest them. When the officer pulled me over, he told me he had read my article. 'I've got it right here in my car,' he said. So I told him, 'Well, if you've read the article, you understand why you can't arrest me right now. If you want to arrest me, go get a warrant from a judge, bring it to my home, and I'll conform to the proper procedures.' Dan had by now locked the car doors and rolled up all the windows, leaving only a 1-inch gap at the top of the driver's window, which, he says, I figured was narrow enough to keep a hand from reaching in and grabbing me, but would allow me to talk to the officer. The trooper wasn't amused. He ordered Dan out of the car. When I refused to get out, says Dan, the cop did something I hadn't anticipated. He grabbed the top of the window with both hands and pulled hard, pulling the window out of its tracks, and then he tried to reach in and grab me. So I said, well, I gotta go now, see you later, and took off. The state troopers gave chase and apprehended Dan a short while later. He was charged with 5 crimes, including second-degree felony escape, third-degree felony assault by a prisoner, and evading an officer, and locked up in the county jail. At his justice court trial, Dan served as his own attorney and attempted to mount a defense based on several arcane points of constitutional law. The judge repeatedly pointed out, however, that justice courts in Utah are not empowered to hear constitutional matters, which infuriated Dan. He was further angered when the judge overruled his objection to the makeup of the 4-woman jury. Dan argued that he was entitled to have at least 1 male on the jury. When Dan ignored the judge's instructions and continued to argue his case on constitutional grounds, the exasperated judge declared him in contempt of court, at which point Dan's brothers and several other supporters staged a riot in the courtroom, shouting that they were placing the judge, prosecutor, and court clerk under citizen's arrest. In the middle of this melee, Dan stood up and loudly admonished the judge, "In the name of Christ, do justice or be struck down." In the end, the theatrics didn't do anything to help his case. Dan was sent to the state prison for a 45-day psychiatric evaluation, then transferred to the county jail to serve a 30-day sentence. His stay behind bars only hardened his resolve. As a matter of principle, he stopped paying the property taxes on his father's home and business. His father's property, Dan explains, was owned free and clear. By paying property taxes, you are basically telling the government that they're the ones who really own the property, because you give them the right to take it from you if you don't pay your taxes. And I was willing to force a standoff to determine who actually owned that property. When that inevitable standoff occurred, Dan did not prevail. The Utah County Assessor notified him that the county was taking possession of the Lafferty home for non-payment of taxes, as well as seizing all of Watson Lafferty's office equipment. At which point Dan politely informed the assessor's office that I intended to defend myself against any invasion of my constitutional God-given rights. Dan's 4 younger brothers fully supported him in his ongoing battles with the state. But when Dan's father, who was still out of the country on his LDS mission, learned that his home and business equipment were about to be auctioned off for non-payment of taxes, he was furious. Watson Sr. called Dan from abroad to express his profound displeasure and to accuse Dan of hypnotizing his brothers. The Lafferty patriarch even suggested that Dan was trying to hypnotize him and Claudine from afar over the telephone line. Watson managed to save his home from the auction block by cutting short his mission and rushing back to Provo with Claudine, but he remained furious at Dan. Although his father's wrath saddened Dan, it did not dissuade him from his crusade. During the last months of 1982 through early 1983, that crusade became more overtly religious, and Dan's 4 younger brothers became increasingly infected with his fundamentalist zeal. The Lafferty boys started meeting on a more regular basis to discuss the merits of polygamy and other principles advocated in The Peacemaker. When 3 of Dan's brothers attempted to impose these principles in their own homes, however, their wives refused and began to complain to Diana, the wife of Ron, the eldest Lafferty brother, about the disturbing changes in their husbands' personalities. Chapter 14. Brenda. Fundamentalist movements are embattled forms of spirituality, which have emerged as a response to a perceived crisis. They are engaged in a conflict with enemies whose secularist policies and beliefs seem inimical to religion itself. Fundamentalists do not regard this battle as a conventional political struggle, but experience it as a cosmic war between the forces of good and evil. They fear annihilation and try to fortify their beleaguered identity by means of a selective retrieval of certain doctrines and practices of the past. To avoid contamination, they often withdraw from mainstream society to create a counterculture. Yet fundamentalists are not impractical dreamers. They have absorbed the pragmatic rationalism of modernity, and under the guidance of their charismatic leaders, they refine these fundamentals so as to create an ideology that provides the faithful with a plan of action. Eventually, they fight back and attempt to re-sacralize an increasingly skeptical world. Karen Armstrong, The Battle for God. Ron and Diana Lafferty lived with their six kids in Highland, a small, prosperous, semi-rural community tucked against the foot of the Wasatch Range, just north of American Fork, midway between Provo and Salt Lake City. In 1982, Ron was a Highland City Councilman and a stalwart of the local LDS congregation, where he had been appointed first counselor to the bishop and was a leader of youth activities. Each LDS congregation, called a ward, is headed by a bishop, a lay member, always Mayo, who must be approved by the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, the topmost peak of the hierarchy that runs the World Church from Salt Lake City. The bishop in turn appoints two counselors who together function as a three-man bishopric that closely oversees everything within their ward. By all accounts, he was a wonderful father to his six children, and he and Diana had an uncommonly solid marriage, a relationship envied by most of their acquaintances. "I remember a marriage that was so happy for 16.5 years, says a close friend of Diana's named Penelope Weiss. "The first thing my daughter said when I told her about what happened, you know, with Dan and Ron and all, she said, that can't be true. She said all of us young girls wanted a marriage just like Ron and Diana's marriage." Ron's apparent contentment, however, masked troubles that had been churning just beneath the surface since childhood. Although his father's violent outbursts scarred all the Lafferty children to some degree, Ron, who had an especially close relationship with his perpetually downtrodden mother, seems to have suffered the greatest emotional damage. According to Richard Wooten, a psychologist who has examined Ron extensively over his 19 years in prison, Ron remembers seeing his mother hit by his father and being so mad that he wished he could have been big enough to have kicked his father's ass. "I think that stayed with him, and it became a pattern by which he kind of handled difficult, mistrustful situations." Ron's anguish wasn't apparent to outsiders. As a child, he had been popular with other kids in the community and brought home decent, if unspectacular, grades. He was also an outstanding athlete who starred on his high school football team and was captain of the wrestling squad. Throughout adolescence and young adulthood, he appeared to thrive. As was expected of high achievers in the Mormon faith, after graduating from high school and completing a stint in the army, he went on a 2-year mission for the church, eager to spread the gospel so that others might experience the incomparable joy of being a Latter-day Saint. There is nothing easy about being a Mormon missionary. Missionaries must pay their own way, and they are required to go wherever in the world the church decides they are needed. In Ron's case, after 4 weeks of indoctrination at the Missionary Training Center in Provo, he was called upon to save souls in Georgia and Florida. As an obedient saint, he had already pledged not to drink, smoke, take illegal drugs, ingest caffeine, masturbate, or engage in premarital sex. All Mormons are supposed to adhere to these strictures, most of which can be traced to a draconian late 20th century interpretation of a confusing revelation Joseph Smith received in 1833, commonly known as the Word of Wisdom, and canonized as Section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants, in which the Lord commanded his saints to abstain from strong drink and certain other vices. As a missionary, he was now also forbidden to read anything but LDS literature or listen to any music not produced by the church. Movies, television, newspapers, and magazines were strictly off-limits. He was permitted to write letters home just once per week, and he could phone his family only on Christmas and Mother's Day. Ron dutifully followed these rules for the most part, but he had a rebellious streak that emerged from time to time. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the warped relationship he had with his father, figures of authority provoked a complicated emotional response in Ron. Part of him was desperately eager to please his superiors, while another part raged inwardly against anyone who held power over him. Every now and then, Ron felt compelled to let his keepers know that they didn't own him. In those days, missionaries were required to wear hats. According to Dr. Wooten, who is Mormon, Ron refused to wear a hat. In the summertime, when it was hot and muggy in Florida, as it is, they were supposed to wear coats. He wouldn't wear a coat. He made a statement at one time that he wasn't down there to make a fashion statement. He was down there to convert people and fulfill a mission. Every morning Ron would roll out of bed at 6 a.m., don black slacks, a crisply pressed white shirt, and an ugly clip-on tie, and then study scripture for 2 or 3 hours before hitting the streets to troll for prospective converts. Like all LDS missionaries, to accomplish the latter, he had to endure insults, threats of physical violence, flying spit, and callous rejection. Typically, he would have a door slammed in his face 40 or 50 times a day. Ron, however, turned out to be astonishingly good at this line of work. Nothing fazed him. The incessant rain of ridicule and dismissal glanced off him as though he had a Teflon hide. Ron knew the LDS Church was God's one true church, and he was determined to share this glorious fact with as many people as he could. Typically, an especially dedicated missionary might convert no more than 3 or 4 people a year and feel justly satisfied for this accomplishment. In recent years, the annual average has been slightly more than 2 conversions per missionary. Ron, in marked contrast, had baptized more than 50 people into the LDS Church by the time his 2-year mission was over. While saving souls in Florida, Ron met a sweet young nursing student, fell in love, and married her at the conclusion of his mission. He then took his new wife, Diana, to Utah so they could live near his parents and siblings. Ron landed a good job operating heavy equipment for a construction company owned by a fellow Mormon and settled down to raise a family of faithful saints. Comfortably reestablished in Utah County, Ron functioned as the emotional anchor for the greater Lafferty clan. His younger brothers and sisters had looked up to him for counseling and emotional support since they were small children. He had tended to be the one who mediated family disagreements. One of Ron's siblings affectionately characterized him as a mother hen type, and he relished the role. For the 2 decades after he returned from his mission, he made certain he was available whenever his mother or his brothers and sisters needed him. By mid-1982, it was apparent to Diana that several of Ron's siblings were in acute need of some brotherly guidance. In August of that year, she became aware that 4 of the other 5 Lafferty wives were being made miserable by the fundamentalist strictures that Dan had been urging his brothers to adopt. So Diana pleaded with Ron to have a talk with Dan and his other brothers to straighten them out. Ron agreed to pay them a visit. One evening when his 5 brothers were meeting at their parents' Provo home to discuss religion and politics, Ron stopped by to join in the discourse, the first time he had ever attended one of these gatherings. His brothers welcomed him warmly, even when he began to read from an essay published by the LDS Church, warning of the evils of fundamentalism and admonishing all saints to obey the teachings of the church's president and prophet, Spencer W. Kimball. As the evening progressed, Ron asked increasingly pointed questions about Dan's new beliefs, and he tried as hard as he could to persuade his younger brothers that Dan's nutty ideas were putting their eternal souls in grave jeopardy. "Ron was embarrassed by me," Dan remembers. "He was a devout saint, and he said I was an embarrassment to the Mormon Church. He told me there's no place in this church for extremes." Conceding nothing, Dan fired back, "Well, how about extremely good? All I'm trying to do is be extremely good." Dan argued with great passion that the LDS Church had taken a wrong turn when it had abandoned polygamy, and that the only way to put it back on a true course was to adopt the sacred tenets advanced in the Peacemaker. Ron tried to refute Dan's arguments point by quoting scripture from the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Dan countered with points of his own drawn from the same texts, as well as from the Constitution. Ron wasn't at that meeting too awfully long, as Dan remembers it, before he stopped trying to convince us we were wrong. "What you guys are doing is right," he admitted. "It's everyone else who is wrong." In the space of a few hours, Dan had converted Ron from a dutiful saint into a fire-breathing Mormon fundamentalist. Diana told her friend Penelope Weiss that when Ron returned home late that night, a totally different man walked in the door. Having adopted their defiant worldview, Ron became a regular attendee at his brother's meetings. He threw away his driver's license and removed the license plates from his vehicle. And then he quit his job, which greatly heightened Diana's concern because the family was already balanced tenuously on the edge of financial ruin. Ron was in the latter stages of what was for him a large construction project, a 4-unit apartment complex he had financed with a bank loan and was building himself after hours as a business investment. Up until this time, after working all day at his real job, he'd been devoting most evenings to building the fourplex and spending the remainder of his nights constructing a dream house in Highland for his own family. His 2 after-hours construction projects were straining their cash flow to the limit and beyond. Compounding their woes, the economy throughout the Rocky Mountain region had just plunged into an abysmal recession. Ron and Diana failed to make the loan payments. There wasn't enough money for groceries or clothes for the kids. Ron began to succumb to the stress. It was a really bad recession, Weiss remembers. Ron was going to lose everything. In fact, the papers were already made up for the bank to take away their home, which he had worked so hard on for so many years. It was during this crisis that Diana, on behalf of her sisters-in-law, asked Ron to visit with his brothers and straighten them out. Ron was really vulnerable right then, Weiss explains. Diana told me at the time that Ron was so upset he would regularly just break down and cry. She'd tell him, "Ron, don't worry about it. We can start over. We did it once. We'll do it again." But he'd just look at her and say, "We've sacrificed too much. I can't bear losing it all." And just then Dan came along, Weiss declares with anguish in her voice. Dan's religious ideas included a message that Ron found particularly comforting during that difficult period. Dan convinced Ron that God didn't want us to have material things, that it was good to lose everything. Dan told him that he had a higher calling, that God intended for Ron to be a missionary for the things Dan was teaching. And Ron really believed it. All of it. In fact, he even quit his job. Dan said it was all going to be okay because he, Ron, was going to be called as the next president and prophet of the LDS Church, that Dan would be made his first counselor, and that the 4 other Lafferty boys would be made second counselors. Very soon after Ron was converted to Dan's brand of fundamentalism, he instructed Diana to begin following the onerous rules set forth in The Peacemaker. "I went over to their house one day," Weiss remembers, "and Diana was shaking and shaking a gallon jug full of cream. I asked her, 'What in the world are you doing?' She said, 'Ron wants me to make our own butter from now on.'" This was just one little example of how Ron expected her to live. Basically, he expected her to be his slave. And it was such a complete reversal from the way he'd been. Before Dan brainwashed him, Ron had treated Diana like a queen. "He was just one of the nicest men I've ever known, but when this happened, he became one of the meanest men I've ever known." Diana could see right away that the changes in Ron were a really bad thing, and I've never seen a woman work harder at trying to save a man. She would stay up most of the night trying to talk sense into him. In the hope of bringing him around and saving him, she tried to remain on his good side by going along with some of his crazy demands. But she was only willing to go so far, and then she'd have to say, "No, Ron, this just isn't right." As Ron became more controlling and more extreme, Diana slowly lost hope that she could change Ron back into the loving father and considerate husband she'd known previously. He began to talk with growing enthusiasm about polygamy, which made her sick to even contemplate. When Ron announced that he intended to marry off their teenage daughters as plural wives, Diana reached her breaking point. Desperately, she turned for help to Weiss and other close friends, to leaders of her LDS ward, and especially to Brenda Lafferty, who was married to Alan, the youngest of the 6 Lafferty brothers. After Dan persuaded his brothers to adopt his fundamentalist beliefs, all their wives acquiesced and submitted, to one degree or another, to the humiliations decreed in The Peacemaker. All their wives, that is, except one. Brenda Wright Lafferty. Intelligent, articulate, and assertive, Brenda stood up to those Lafferty boys, says her mother, Larae Wright. She was probably the youngest of the wives, but she was the strong one. She told the other wives to stand up for their rights and to think for themselves, and she set an example by refusing to go along with Alan's demands. She told him in no uncertain terms that she didn't want him doing things with his brothers. And the brothers blamed her for that, for keeping their family apart. The Lafferty boys didn't like Brenda because she got in their way. Brenda was the 2nd oldest of 7 children raised by Larae, a schoolteacher, and Jim Wright, an agronomist. Born in Logan, Utah, Brenda moved with her family to Ithaca, New York, when she was just a year old, in order for her father to obtain his doctorate at Cornell University. Jim and Larae pined for the wide-open country of the Rocky Mountain West, but upstate New York was not without appeal, and there was a major attraction just up the road from Ithaca, Palmyra, the birthplace of their LDS faith. As soon as he received his Ph.D., however, Jim moved his family back to the West, to Twin Falls, Idaho, an agricultural town 40 miles north of the Utah state line, where Brenda enjoyed a storybook childhood. She was outgoing, full of life, and had a lot of personality, says her older sister Betty Wright McIntyre. Brenda was just real fun. We were best friends. Popular, active in school government, and a member of the drill team, Brenda was an ambitious student who excelled at almost everything she tried. She was also beautiful in the wholesome, all-American farm girl idiom. In 1980, she was first runner-up in the Miss Twin Falls pageant. After graduating from high school with honors, Brenda enrolled at the University of Idaho, where she was elected president of her sorority. But, says her mother, that wasn't the kind of life she wanted to lead, so she came back to Twin Falls and went to the College of Southern Idaho for 2 years, then transferred to Brigham Young University. While attending BYU, Brenda joined a young adult ward, an LDS student congregation, where she met Alan Lafferty. Alan wasn't a student, but for some reason he started attending that student ward in Provo, Larae explains. He had a lot of charisma, they hit it off, and they just started going together. When Brenda started going out with Alan, I was out of the country on a mission in Argentina, her sister Betty says. But she wrote to me every week, and I could tell she was pretty serious about this guy. She'd dated a lot of boys before, but she never got stuck on any one person. Alan was different. He was a returned missionary, and Lafferty's were the picture-perfect LDS family. Everybody in Provo seemed to know them. Plus, Alan is a charmer. All the Lafferty boys have this ability to charm the socks off you. They have this look in their eyes. And Brenda fell for it. Even from Argentina, it was obvious she was really in love with Alan. On April 22, 1982, Alan and Brenda were sealed for time and eternity as husband and wife in the Salt Lake City Temple. She was 21 years old. At BYU, where Brenda majored in communications, she anchored a television news magazine program on KBYU. The local PBS affiliate broadcast throughout Utah on Channel 11. According to Betty, her ambition was to become an anchorwoman, like Michelle King. Currently the popular co-anchor of the evening news on KUTV, Salt Lake City's CBS affiliate, Michelle King graduated from the BYU Communications Department just 2 years before Brenda did. We were brought up to be very independent. Our parents taught us that we were given certain talents and we needed to pursue them, that we shouldn't go through life relying on others when we had all these abilities. Then Brenda got married and Alan didn't want her to work, so she kind of put her broadcasting career on the shelf temporarily and took a lower-profile job at Castleton's, one of the nicer stores at the Orem Mall, just to get insurance and help support the family. But Alan started pressuring her to quit that job, too, because he wanted her to be a traditional, subservient wife. He wanted her to be totally reliant on him. According to Larae, Brenda really wanted a career in broadcast journalism. We found out later after the fact that she had been offered a job at BYU, teaching in the communications department. Alan wouldn't let her take it, though, so she became a housewife. It's clear from her journals that within about 2 months after marrying Alan, she realized she had made a mistake. But then she got pregnant with Erica. When Alan first became part of our family, says Betty, there was this instant attachment. We all liked him. He was like a wonderful big brother to us. At the time, we had no idea that there was all this other stuff going on in his family. Then we started to notice how fanatical they all were. Betty remembers visiting Brenda and Alan one night when her sister was pregnant with Erica. Brenda wanted to go out and get something to eat, but Alan wouldn't patronize any restaurant that stayed open on Sundays. So we drove around from place to place, and Alan would make us sit in the car while he went in to find out if they were open on Sundays. Each place was, so he wouldn't let us eat there. After a while, Brenda and I got so frustrated, we just asked him to take us home. Alan had a very successful tile business, but he insisted on always being paid in cash. He didn't believe in having a checking account because he didn't want the IRS to be able to trace his income. He didn't want to have a Social Security card. None of this came out until after they got married. We started noticing that Alan was always trying to get around the law. When it came time to pay taxes that first year after they got married, Alan told Brenda that he wasn't going to pay them. She said, "Oh, yes, we are. That's what you do. You honor the law." When Alan refused, she had our dad help her prepare the taxes for them. I remember when the car registration came due, Alan wouldn't let Brenda go get it registered. She told him, "Yes, I am, because I don't want to get a ticket." They had a big fight about it. We just weren't raised like that. So she always made sure to do the things they were supposed to. She paid the taxes, renewed the licenses, those kinds of things. She resisted Alan as much as she could. But then the baby got sick and he wouldn't let Brenda take Erica to the doctor. And it just kept getting worse and worse. Alan's father, Watson Lafferty Sr., had long been afflicted with diabetes, which he refused to treat with insulin. In late 1983, after he and Claudine had returned from their mission and were again living in the family home in Provo, Watson's diabetes took a sharp turn for the worse. His sons continued to refuse medical treatment for him, however. Their herbal and homeopathic remedies failed to alleviate the illness, and he died. "The whole family seemed evil to Brenda by then," says Betty. Then and there, she could tell something really bad was going on with them. Life was growing more horrific for Diana Lafferty, too. Her home in Highland was just a few minutes away from the small apartment where Alan, Brenda, and their baby were living in American Fork. Overwhelmed and desperate, Diana turned to Brenda for help. Although Brenda held stubbornly to her belief that she could turn Alan around, she was convinced that Ron was too far gone, and that he would never abandon his fanatical ideas. Both Ron and Dan had been excommunicated from the LDS Church. Ron no longer had a job. He was increasingly abusive to Diana and talked with ever greater fervor about taking plural wives. Brenda urged Diana to divorce Ron for her children's sake and her own. Leaving Ron was all but unthinkable for Diana. As she later explained to the Utah County prosecutor, she had 6 children, hadn't graduated from college, had never held a job, and possessed no marketable skills. "I can't even type," she confessed in despair. But at her core, she knew Brenda was right. Leaving Ron was imperative. Relying on Brenda, close friends, and members of the Highland LDS ward, Diana summoned enough courage to initiate divorce proceedings. The divorce was finalized in the autumn of 1983. Around Thanksgiving, Diana packed up the kids and moved to Florida, putting as much space as she could between her and the Lafferty boys. Even though he'd had every opportunity to see it coming, the departure of his wife and children came as a stunning blow to Ron. Despondent at the prospect of Christmas without them, he planned to spend the holidays far from Utah, where he was reminded of his missing family everywhere he turned. Ron decided to visit a colony of polygamists near Woodburn, Oregon, headed by a charismatic figure named John W. Bryant. Before landing in Woodburn, a farm town just north of Salem, the Oregon state capital, Bryant had established polygamist settlements in Utah, California, and Nevada. Like so many other renegade prophets, he had on occasion asserted that he was the one mighty and strong, but he differed from his fundamentalist brethren in some unusual aspects. Bryant was a libertine by temperament, and his teachings emphasized experimentation with drugs and group sex, homosexual as well as heterosexual, proclivities seldom acknowledged by other Mormon fundamentalists. Such scandalous behavior was completely new to Ron, who was both enthralled and taken aback by what he saw during his extended visit to Bryant's commune. When one of the prophet's wives let Ron know she found him attractive, Ron was extremely tempted to hop into bed with her, but he worried that doing so might make Bryant jealous and angry, so he left and returned to Utah. Ron arrived back in the Provo area just after Bernard Brady had introduced Dan to Prophet Onias, the Canadian fundamentalist. Dan in turn introduced Onias to Ron and the other Lafferty brothers, and very soon thereafter, Ron, Dan, Mark, Watson, and Tim Lafferty were inducted into Onias's School of the Prophets. Alan, the youngest sibling, was eager to participate as well, but Brenda put her foot down. She refused to let Alan join, Lorraine Wright confirms. Although standing up to Alan meant standing up to the entire Lafferty clan, Brenda did not shy away from such confrontations. Not only was she quite willing to argue theology with the Lafferty brothers, she possessed an impressive command of LDS scripture that allowed her to more than hold her own when debating fundamentalist doctrine with Ron and Dan. They came to despise her for defying them and for her influence over Alan, whom they considered pussy-whipped. When Ron's father was dying of diabetes, Ron had called a family meeting to discuss the funeral and other details. Alan brought Brenda to the meeting, which made Ron furious. He called her a bitch and worse, and berated her with such unrestrained spleen that Brenda finally left in tears. But she did not remain intimidated very long. Brenda was the only one of the Lafferty wives who was educated, Betty points out, and her education was what they were afraid of. Because Brenda was confident in her beliefs and her sense of right and wrong, and she wasn't about to let anyone take that away from her. She felt it was her duty to defend the other women. She was their only hope. Reflecting on the load her little sister had shouldered, Betty pauses before continuing. At that point, she was still just 23 years old. To be that young, and to be surrounded by all these older people who were supposed to be more mature than she was, yet she was the one they turned to. Betty pauses again. My sister was an amazing woman. Although Brenda managed to keep Alan from joining Onias's school of the prophets, she could not prevent him from associating with Dan and his other brothers. But she tried to keep a watchful eye on him, says Betty. Around this time, my little sister Sharon and I went to visit Brenda and Alan. While we were there, Brenda made sure that whenever Alan went anywhere, either Sharon or I went with him. Then, when we'd get home, she'd question us about where he went and who he talked to. At the time, I thought that was kind of weird. Now I see that she was just trying to keep tabs on how much he was talking to his brothers. Chapter 15. The One Mighty and Strong. As a religious city-state under tight control, Nauvoo was a haven where the followers of Joseph Smith had their most important choices, what they should do to serve God, made for them, and their identity as God's chosen people was assured through him. As is common in such situations, the threat of evil was projected onto others. Hence, at Nauvoo, the innocent children of God realized their identity through their struggle against the evil followers of Satan, who dominated American society everywhere except in the City of the Saints. The problem, of course, with this kind of dichotomous myth is that for the people who hold it, guilt and innocence become matters of belief, not evidence. John E. Howes and Roger D. Lanius, Cultures in Conflict. When the Utah businessman and dream mind supporter Bernard Brady brought Prophet Onias and the Lafferty brothers, minus Alan, together one crisp fall evening near the end of 1983, it seemed to all who were present to be an especially auspicious union. There was an instant feeling of kinship and shared values, and the men talked excitedly until the wee hours of the morning, according to Onias. Giddy with their sense of divinely empowered mission, everyone at the gathering was convinced that collectively they were destined to alter the course of human history. Five of the six brothers, Onias said, became extremely enthusiastic when they realized that we had just been given a commandment by the Lord to send three sections of the Book of Onias to all the stake and ward authorities. The Book of Onias is an alternative title for the Second Book of Commandments. They are the same book. The LDS Church is organized into stakes of approximately 3,000 members, which are the rough equivalent of archdioceses in the Catholic Church, and wards, which are the neighborhood congregations within each stake. Typically, each stake is made up of between 5 and 12 wards. He was referring to a revelation he'd received on November 26th of that year, in which God had commanded Onias to prepare pamphlets to send out to the presidents of stakes and bishops of wards of my church, the LDS Church, so that those who had committed fornication against him would be warned. The pamphlet consisted of excerpts from Onias's collected revelations, cautioning the entire LDS leadership, from the president and putative prophet in Salt Lake City down to the bishop of every ward across North America, that God was extremely unhappy with the way they'd been running his one true church. God was especially steamed, Onias explained, that modern Mormon leaders were blatantly defying some of the most sacred doctrines he had revealed to Joseph Smith in the 19th century. Most egregiously, the men at the helm of the church continued to sanction and zealously enforce the government's criminalization of plural marriage. And only slightly less disturbing from Onias's perspective was the blasphemy perpetrated by LDS President Spencer W. Kimball in 1978, when he decreed that black-skinned men should be admitted into the Mormon priesthood. A historic, earth-shaking turnabout in church policy, widely applauded by those outside the church. God had revealed to Onias, however, that blacks were subhuman beasts of the field, which were the most intelligent of all animals that were created, for they did walk upright as man doeth, and had the power of speech. In the LDS faith, all males deemed worthy are inducted into the priesthood at the age of 12, which entails the assignment of specific responsibilities and privileges, as well as conferring inestimable status within the church. Before 1978, blacks were denied admission into the priesthood, a major affront that helps explain why there are relatively few Mormons of African descent. Women of all races continue to be barred from the priesthood. According to the pamphlet, God had given Onias an earful about blacks being ordained as LDS priests. "Behold, I say unto you, at no time have I given a commandment unto my church, nor shall I, that the children of Ham, even the Negro race and all its peoples, should receive my holy priesthood. And have I not spoken to my servant Joseph Smith, even your head, that none of this race could or would be ordained to my holy priesthood until the seed of Abel shall rise above the seed of Cain? For Satan was the founder of this black race, for he came to Cain after God had taken away his power to procreate the children of righteousness, and showed him how he could place his seed into animals, and the seed of animals into other animals, for he did corrupt the seed of the earth in this manner, hoping to thwart the works of God. And for this reason the earth was destroyed by the flood, to destroy from the face of the earth these abominations which Cain created, for he had corrupted all flesh. For Satan has infiltrated my church and seeketh to become its head. But those who have heeded him shall shortly be exposed by their folly, for neither my name nor my church shall be mocked longer, for it shall shortly be cleansed and purged and tried in the fire, that all those who profess to know me and know me not will be exposed." The pamphlet further warned that God had dispatched Onias to cleanse my house of its filthiness and put the institutions of Mormondom back on the road to righteousness. God had revealed, "I shall endow Onias with my spirit, and the wicked he shall expose, and they shall not stand, and they shall gnash their teeth in anger, and their anger shall eat them up. For I am the Lord God Almighty, and my words shall not be mocked. And what a great noise and commotion they shall make when they fall. And my servant, Onias, who is held in derision, I shall place in him my spirit, and he shall be as a fire that devoureth. And the words that he shall write and speak shall expose many and cause many to fall, for they repent not." By sending this pamphlet to the leaders of the LDS Church, Onias intended to give them the opportunity to make a choice. Confess their errors and turn over control of the church to the Lord's chosen prophet, the one mighty and strong, or face God's wrath. To a detached observer, this seems like an act of astonishing naivete and hubris on Onias' part, but the pamphlet's text resonated with tremendous power for the Lafferty brothers. It had the ring of long-denied truth. They believed they had found in Onias a crucial ally in their struggle to restore the Church of Joseph Smith to righteousness and prepare the earth for the second coming of Christ. Onias was no less enamored of the Laffertys and what they could do to advance his ambitions for the school of the prophets. Applying the full brunt of their prodigious energy, the Lafferty brothers dived headlong into the tedious chore of printing, folding, and collating more than 15,000 of Onias' pamphlets, then addressing and mailing them to LDS leaders around the country. It was like a miracle to us, Onias says, for what would have taken us several months to accomplish in our spare time, they were able to accomplish in 2 weeks, working day and night. By early 1984, the newly established School of the Prophets was meeting on a weekly basis, usually at the Provo home of the Lafferty's mother, Claudine, upstairs from the family chiropractic clinic. Thanks to the enthusiasm of the five brothers, the school got off to a flying start. Onias appreciated the Lafferty's pivotal